and maybe McLuhan as well. I can imagine that, or could even agree that McLuhan enjoyed this sort of predictable miscategorization and projection that his that he was subject to in other people's eyes, that people easily mistook him for a sociologist or something, and that's amusing to him.
That's a great point,
but
Brian.
I wouldn't call it fraud.
That's right. It's not fraud. It's satire. So McLuhan and Bob, they are being satirists because they know how their audience is going to respond. The show began with Bob, was it Lisa? Who was reading?
Kate.
So, this episode began with Kate reading Bob, rambling off his conspiracy theory shit in front of an audience, I guess, right? Yeah. And Bob knows that, well, the audience doesn't give a shit, and he's absolutely indulging in the perverse performance of absurdism to this audience, right? But it's not fraudulent, because everything he was saying was actual true facts about whatever the hell was going on politically in America in 1980, whatever the fuck. But that's not my point. My point, Greg, is that you have found yourself in a social group of loner, introspective weirdos. And most of what we talk about... most of what we talk about is the lived experience of people who have no one else to talk about the stuff they're thinking about with. And so everything you say is Cajun. Here's my reaction to this thing I read about a thing the guy said, because we're not talking to anybody about this shit. And then I come along and I actually went to a bar and met a schizo and all this crazy shit happened. It's like, oh, fine, Clinton's actually a real human being alive or was he talking sense for once? It's like, yeah, I do actually go out. I just never talk about it because lonely people are too busy navel-gazing at the reflections in the mirrors that are happening inside their head. And McLuhan's really good for helping you go through the reflections in the hall of mirrors in your head in a way way better than everyone else, who is actually a fraud.
Can I say real quick, so I don't think I've had the pleasure of speaking with Greg when he's been on here, but how long has Greg known Bob? Is it like 20 years? Something ridiculous?
Well, I've known of Bob. I'm the 20 years. Linus is the 20 years guy. Greg is more than that.
Okay.
I can answer it pretty quickly. I've known of Bob for, I would say, well, it'd be close to 40 years. I knew of him because of his work on a radio station in Toronto. And I became, I would say, an avid listener and follower of his work. Then Bob disappeared from Toronto, apparently, and disappeared from my life for about another 10 years or so. And then just because I happened to be doing his program at being the host of a program that had been created by Bob, I was doing it in 2000, and it just so happened that Bob actually came to Toronto in 2001, around September the 11th, and after he'd committed the terrorist attacks, and I was apprised of the fact by someone at the station that he was there, because I talked so much about this guy, Bob. And then, so that the program director phoned me up and said, hey, that guy's coming into town. He's going to be on Jerry Belanger's program tonight. So that would have been the night that I would have met Bob for the first time. And then he would have been on my show. And that's where I knew Bob personally. I think the only interaction I might have had with Bob before that, I might have spoken to him on the phone once. And I think once I phoned in to the show. That's the episode that I might have lost track of it, but I'll find it. I did find the episode where I phoned in. I was in Cleveland, Ohio, and phoned in to the show. And maybe I'm not finding it because I'm sure it'd be it's embarrassing to listen to. So that's how
You just found this recently, Greg?
No, I think I found it. I found it a few. It could be a couple of years ago now. I found it, and then I find things because I'm doing a massive digitization of my entire video library and that video library of my father's. In fact, as I've been sitting here, I've been recording what amounts to be about 14 or 15 hours of material on three different machines. In fact, I hear one rewinding at the moment. So I find stuff that I recorded on there just that was never, some of it never cataloged. So I come across stuff and I go, oh, then I get it to Bob or send it to Bob, but I look for that. I did put it away somewhere. Yeah, we do. So that's the long and short of it. So around, I met him physically in 2001.
September 19th, we know the exact date.
Okay, so just to summarize some of the things you said earlier, just real quick, Greg, it's kind of like a fence-sitting position with Bob in the sense that you think he enjoys people, quotation marks, you find as fraudulent, and that he may find some kind of enjoyment out of propping up those people or putting them on. Is that pretty fair, or did I misunderstand?
Well, I think he admires people who can do that.
Oh, well, also,
and I think Bob fashions some of his antics along those lines. And I think there's a justification that he finds in it because he goes, well, that's what McLuhan did, or that's what, LaRouche did, or well, that's what Zappa did. I think that he goes, well, it's acceptable,
Well, Greg, may I just present a differentiation here, because what Bob is doing is Forrest Gumping himself as some sort of pivotal person into history, where he's the guy who killed Kennedy, and he's the guy who sent a letter to Prince Charles to cause what's and what. He caused 9/11, and his wife caused COVID, and so that's what you're calling fraudulent.
Well, no, I'm not calling that. I'm not necessarily calling that fraudulent. I'm just saying. I mean, it could be. It's because the line between what is real, what's true, what's a lie, and completely blurred. I mean, I'd be just interjecting in every time and going, Bob, that's a lie. Bob, that's a lie. I don't do that. I just let Bob go on and say whatever he wants to say, and so does everybody else. And there's only occasionally will I challenge Bob or question Bob about, like, something that comes up. And
yes.
And Bob always has an answer. There's always an answer.
Great. I'm in the same boat as you insofar as Bob's wild confabulation and megalomaniacal self-insertion into all the narratives of history is insane. Nevertheless, his theories behind what's causing other shit too, or whatever the fuck I'm saying, I agree. Nevertheless, also, having read a lot of McLuhan, Bob understands him better than most, I dare say nearly all.
Bob's incredibly clever. I mean, only someone that's incredibly clever. But even if I'm right about what I'm saying, only someone incredibly clever would have the audacity to proceed as he does and to hoik up, who he admires. Who are could be construed as being frauds. I'm sure I'm not the first person to I'm not going to say that McLuhan was a fraud. I'm going to say it possibly was, and that I bet I'm not the first person to say that.
Well, that's a common thing. That's the mainstream audience laughing at McLuhan. you know, when he's giving those speeches, just laughing at every little thing. So I think that's like a commonality. They could not tell with McLuhan. He would talk openly about the put on and the take off, you know, so he would definitely do that to people. That's like a pretty common thing. What I will say real quick, isn't it crazy? I'm not sure, because somebody else showed me Bob, but I was well aware of some Bob shit that is particularly at this person that I found on my own before I even knew who he was. So isn't it crazy? And it seems like you guys have come across some of this, in your times. Isn't it crazy that he has the ability to lay the ground way before he pops up?
Okay, but at this point, Greg has lost you. What do you mean lay the ground?
Okay, let me say it like this. So with some of the people that he talks about, when you look at Discordianism or anything like that, that whole vibe, that whole level of obscurity between, are these guys just laughing at me? But at the same time, they're pointing to very real events. They're pointing to the associations with Carrie Thornley or Lee Harvey Oswald. Or if we want to talk about Wernher von Braun and who actually captured him. If we want to talk about some of those things that come up through Discordian works or Robert Anton Wilson works or any of that, there's definitely a level of where you look at a lot of Discordians or subgenius and you do not take these guys very seriously at all. And I have come into contact with many of these people who I don't take seriously at all. But there is some serious substance behind the common tropes or the common topics that come up. In that same sense, without getting into too many of the specifics, because, you know, this is something I haven't openly talked about. When I was talking to Bob earlier, I was talking about basically all the stuff he's already covered, everything that he's posted, and not some of the little strands I picked up on my own. When we discuss these topics and the ability to blend whatever it is, either Bob Dobbs or Discordianism, with this kind of jocularity of, you know, we're just fucking with you or we're just putting you on, it does become difficult. One time is an anomaly, two times, you know, whatever, but three times, I mean, at a certain point you have to say, well, these are either very intelligent people who are predicting things that will come, that will actually happen in the future just based on the present, or they're actually tied into something. Does that make sense?
That absolutely makes sense. Yeah, that's my experience.
But I mean,
okay, so I have a very similar experience. Everything that Brian has said up to this point, I don't take everything that Brian says, you know, like that's my identity now. But I do everything, every conversation that me and Brian have had or that he's chimed in on, I'm in very much of, I can see that. That's certainly a possibility.
Right. Sweet.
Right, 100%. But this is a level of pattern recognition going on here. And Greg, if you'll suffer one more pointed finger at you, it's that, like, you don't actually see the patterns that Bob's subliminally refers to, which is knitting together all this meaning making of all of these lost souls who are suddenly seeing the light when Bob reveals something deep about the nature of the world. You see me and Brian and like everyone else here like moths around the flame in some sense or another, and I'm much more like you, Greg, insofar as I call bullshit on Bob just as much as I revel in his learning. But also, there is something there, and we're not all just getting taken in by bullshit.
I recognize that you're. I mean, you're interested in something deeply. You know, I'm not laughing at the idea that you're interested in something, because just because I don't understand it,
right.
And I do listen, But yeah. you're right that I don't quite see the. No, you're right. I don't see the drift of it. I mean, I hear.
Yeah,
I think
fraud, but it's not all fraud.
I didn't say it was all fraud. I mean, it's not. But
yeah,
I think
but you're emphasizing the fraud too much.
Well, okay.
You're not winnowing. You don't have the sieve to winnow the wheat from the chaff. You know.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's spoken about in clear enough terms. It's spoken a lot of jargon. There's a lot of jargon involved.
Yeah.
And you all know the jargon. The thing is that you're almost speaking in code.
Yeah.
It's not plain.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And
you're not disassembling it. You're going, hey, I'm an expert about McLuhan. I'm an expert about McLuhan, and I'm an expert about McLuhan. And we're all going to get together, and we're going to do all the jargon together. And we don't care whether anybody else understands it, because
so back to Catherine's question.
We expect them to understand all the jargon.
Go tell
five
them
sovereign fingers, baby.
Tax the breath. But Greg, it's like, you know, the Eskimo sees 50 kinds of snow. We only see snow. You see just sort of fraud or babble, and you don't see the 50 kinds of meaning that's going on, which you're calling.
No, well,
right
I'm not saying that there might not be meaning there. When I say fraud, I mean it's that. I mean, well, in saying what I'm saying, then I'm actually implicating myself. I'm saying, hey, you know, I enjoy Bob because I like people who are, I'm fascinated by someone who might be interested in people who sort of admire some level of fraudulent activity by people. And I'm like a fan, right? I have a fascination about it too. Now,
yeah.
I might be wrong. Maybe you don't see McLuhan as some kind of somewhat of a fraudulent figure, that he sort of used his whatever he was doing to draw people in some way.
It seems timely to say this. I like when Zappa said, it's weird being alive. McLuhan, LaRouche, and that, they had a deep sense of humor about it all. And that's what I like. They are serious and do what they do, but they're ready to laugh about it because they don't totally identify with being alive. Or they recognize there's a weird mystical mystery of life that he calls, Zappa calls weird. It's the sense of weirdness. You get that in McLuhan. You see it when he's on video talking to Norm Mailer. You can see a little twinkle in his eye. He knows it's almost a childhood perception that you keep as an adult.
Yeah, and I think even when I'm involved with the program, maybe not so much in recent times, but a little bit, that my interjections are often finding something that I find amusing about what's happened.
Yeah.
You know? And
well, that would be the weirdness, the humor part of it all.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, and of course it's what I think is funny, you know, I mean, maybe other people don't think it's funny, but I'm, you know,
you're exercising your funny gland. That's what's important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hear something, right. And sometimes it would be better if I were to be able to say whatever I was going to say at a perfect time within that conversation. But it's actually very difficult, sort of from a technological point of view, I think, sometimes more than anything else, to actually have the timing work properly.
Oh, sure. I found socialization in high school to be like I was the only kid who couldn't play double Dutch jump rope. I couldn't jump in the way everyone else seemed to just effortlessly jump in. And here we are talking into microphones, not even seeing each other. And the ability to jump in is made all that harder. And it's funny that now we, presumably the people talking McLuhan, are all just riffing off each other. And you, Greg, feel like the socially awkward one who can't quite get in. Cause
well, also, you know, what you're suggesting,
people, So it's like, it's meta somehow. It's like one advance, it's like one layer more socially awkward or less or something. I'm not sure.
Well, I wonder, you know, if I have to think about what you're saying and your approach here, is that, is it that what our purpose is here, not only just the 4 or 5 or whatever it is, or 6, 7, 8, 10, whatever it is part of our reason for being here to try to convince and control the others?
I'm
not like that at all.
Well, actually, let's examine that for a minute.
That's what you're accused of. You're accused of that all the time.
I'll go after everybody. Bob's trying to convince people of at least two things. There are many things, but of two things, three things, that Carolyn Dean is the savior of the medical world, that the RNA drops are incredibly important, and that ION, that he created, is a very important figure. Now, it isn't all the time, but it's peppered in there. And then your statement to me, you're saying, Clinton, Greg, all these years you've been here, why haven't you come around to our way of thinking about McLuhan? Why aren't you able to converse? Why aren't you able to speak about McLuhan the way we do? Or why aren't you able to bring valuable insights in a McLuhan-esque fashion? So in a sense, that projects the idea that I haven't, it's like the invasion of the body snatchers, you know? And with Madeline, Madeline, for instance, Madeline's thing occasionally, and she did it today and she did it last week or week before, she's trying to convince us that maybe ION isn't that important. She won't say that, but she'll praise ION and all that, but she wants us to be followers of Q. Now, you might say Brian, it's harder to Brian's sort of a little bit all over the place about that. I mean, I wouldn't particularly focus too much on what he's trying to control.
I got you right where I want you.
Who else? Gene. Well, okay. I'm trying to say, everybody, watch out. There are Nazis out there. They're awful. They're coming to get you. And the only way that you can avoid this Nazism, the only reason that you don't see it is because you haven't accepted, you're too anti-communist, right? So that is the recurring theme with me. And then Jean, now she's an interesting one. Bert's trying to convince people that ION's very important, but he's always referencing the Bible. He's always going back to the Bible. So he's trying to, without being told incredibly overt, he's trying to get us to be more righteous, Christian.
Okay, Christian.
Who, Bert is?
Yeah, Bert's trying to get us, he's trying to express some level of righteousness. And he's not demanding it, but he's banging away at it all the time. He's always referencing biblical things. And that is a common theme amongst a lot of the people that are on the interface with the program, is there's always this reference to religion and the Bible and so on and so forth. And so I think that everybody's trying to break down the barriers of the other. With no success.
Okay, so first of all, Greg, may I compliment you, because you are a very intelligent and discerning person who is entirely able to differentiate and give a personal voice to each individual who you just named. So you thought deeply as much as you can, or you just naturally were able to differentiate the voices of this discordant choir of ours who can't seem to find the key or can't seem to find the harmony. And I have a very different experience of streams like this. People blend together. I don't even remember who said what. You're all one giant mono voice to me. I couldn't tell you what Gene thought differentiated from what Bert thought differentiated from what anyone else thought. I'm completely different in that regard. So it seems to me that you are very rightly avoiding falling into what is very clearly a crazy cult, because if you were to believe Bob about one thing, you'd have to believe him about everything, because as an individual, it's sort of like he's a take-it-or-leave-it package. You believe it all or you don't, because you can't separate the McLuhan from the Bob, and you can't separate the anyone else, the Thompson or the Croker or the Lyndon LaRouche or the Brussels from the Bob, because Bob just melds them all together. And it's like, when I listen to Bob, I am literally pulling him apart into his very handy self, like he's surrendered unto me the puzzle, like the pieces I can pull him apart into, and I can differentiate him. But Bob's a lump sum package for you. Does that make sense? But also, it's a lump sum package that you're differentiating from all these other characters. And all these other characters and Bob are all a melange mixed together for me. And I can't pull the whole conversation apart into its individuals, and you can. But I can pull each individual apart into their constituent beliefs.
Well, I think what I have is a bias in some of the things. Like I don't know whether other people express that bias. You do a little bit, Clinton. But, like, for instance, my bias would be that when Bob's talking about, let's say, Mae Brussel,
yeah.
Well, I don't know as much about Mae Brussel's Bob, but I'm quite familiar with her and her work.
Right.
So Lyndon LaRouche, Bob's more expert about it, but I have, on my own without his direct encouragement, you know, I've looked into Lyndon LaRouche and had experiences there. With Zappa, I've heard of Zappa and heard his music long before I had anything to do with Bob, and I would consider myself a fan. I mean, I'm a fan, but, you know, I've just said, well, that Bob likes him because he's a bit of a fraud, you know? I mean, so it's not that I'm condemning people that I go, well, I don't like them. I'm a fan of Frank Zappa, but sometimes I think that he was maybe a bit fraudulent about things.
Okay, do you have your own authorities to whom you trust, and relative to them, us here are best kept at an arm's length for assimilation into your rational processes?
So are you saying, do I have people that I
trust more than us? And I hope you do, but I'm asking you to talk about how and why.
Trusting. Well, that's a pretty trust. Well, that's, you know, trust with what, right? I mean, they're when you mention that, I mean, I think they're people that I would trust to do things for me, that where, you know, maybe I wouldn't trust somebody else to do it.
Mm-hmm. Trust to do.
Yes, a task. Yes. Something that I need to have done or comes up and I go, oh, well, who would I get to do that? And then I think, well, I've got these people that I could do it. well, that one's the best person to do this because I trust them more. Because it might be something where they're involved with, like, okay, let's say I'm away from home and I need something in the house.
Yeah.
Well, there's someone that has the key to the house, all right? So just in giving them the key to the house, well, I trust them.
Okay, so are the people you trust to do your thinking for you? Like, say, Karl Marx?
Thinking for me. Well, I guess with, in certain areas, I guess. I mean, but at the same time, I can be very critical of those people. You know, if something doesn't add up, if what they're saying 1 minute and then something else happens and it doesn't add up, well, you know, I'll address it. I will address it with them. Because it bothers me. Because I wonder, is this a conflict that I'm having personally, or is this a real conflict?
Well, Greg, real quick, could somebody ever have a certain type of position, like a level of confidence, where they could just, where they could really know what they're talking about, but also just go off into weird tangents and just bullshit around and be funny, but also in certain areas be a real authority or actually know what they're talking about? Isn't that always a possibility?
Yeah, like you're.
Well, I think Bob's an authority about. I think Bob's an authority about a lot of things. What I would call an authority. Now, maybe there's things he's talking about that maybe aren't right, but it would seem to me that he's an authority. I would say that Bob's an authority about Zappa. I would say Bob's an authority about McLuhan. I'd say Bob.
Now, is that only because he knows the words and he's able to speak it like he is intelligent about it, or is that because of some other research, maybe some chit body research where you found him associated with these other people in other forms that weren't just coming from his mouth?
I think Bob, I would say, is a very learned person. It could be it's just in a small area, but as far as I can see, it's pretty broad knowledge. And he can speak authoritatively about a lot of things. And I've never really found that when he intervenes or interjects with something where something comes up, and he interjects and puts in some kind of a fact or whatever. I've never found it to be wrong. It's very knowledgeable. I mean, he has a lot of areas where he has no A, interest, and B, and therefore no knowledge. You can clearly see what Bob is interested in.
Yeah, there are very many ignorances from which you can start a novel conversation with Bob where you have the total advantage.
Bob has a lot of gaps, right? But mm-hmm. where, I mean, I'm saying it's a gap because it's a gap I don't have, right?
But
lots of people have gaps.
How many people speak in a way which reveal their gaps so openly, so unprotected? So, it's very hard for me to talk to someone for 20 minutes and see where all their gaps are, where all their absences are. How does someone portray in their language everything they don't know and cannot speak about? That's a very strange property, don't you think?
What, did I notice that?
Well, that anyone, that Bob could speak in a way which reveals his ignorances.
Well, I don't think he speaks in that way. I think what happens is a topic will come up, and it's totally outside of his knowledge. He's lived during a particular era. He's lived in a place where he'd likely be subject to knowing about something, yet he doesn't seem to know anything about it.
I was talking about lonely people earlier. Bob was for many stretches of his life, clearly a very lonely, insular guy who missed out on a great many pop cultural phenomena. Now, if pop cultural phenomena, if culture is the bland corporate produced bullshit that ties people together so that you can go to the bar and go talk about that latest show on Netflix, which is what it's like for me going to the bar. It's mostly everyone saying, hey, have you seen this show on Netflix? No. Have you seen that show on Netflix? No. Right? That if the glue which makes society commune is pop culture bullshit, then you're right. Bob has many glaring absences of the great historical memory-making things that tied culture together, right?
Yeah, he's very focused. He's very focused on certain things. And I guess, you know, this is important for him to be able to glean all these things. I'll give you an example of where, you know, that happened today, all right, on the program. That demonstrated, unknowingly, I think, to the person that was involved, you know, gaps in knowledge that for me were surprising. But then I had to go, well, maybe it's just surprising to me, right? Like when Kate was reading the transcript or something about what Bob had said at some gathering a while ago, 4 decades ago. I mean, it inadvertently revealed like gaps in her knowledge about this history or things like that. Like she was reading the things, but she didn't understand what she was reading. And it became clear quite a few times. So you get that. I don't think she was trying to pretend that she was an expert about anything. She was just reading something that she transcribed. But in doing that, it revealed something about her. You know, about where her knowledge is.
Right.
And I think,
want to say this real quick.
It isn't where it isn't.
So, Greg, though, but in terms of when you talk to Bob and you talk of him as an authority, is that purely based on what Bob is able to communicate to you from, you know, his own voice? Or are any of those thoughts about him being an authority, do those ever come from other sources, chip body resources that you've actually done the research and you're like, wow, Bob pops up here. You know, he obviously, you know, he knows this group. Does anything like that ever happen for you?
First of all, before Greg answers, you are already, I'm not sure Greg knows what you mean by chip body. And I mean, I know that's elementary, but I'm honestly, the whole line of questioning is like, do you even know what he means by chip body research, Greg?
Well, I gather that it means that you've... Well, here's my gap. All right, I think it's more about the and for the lack of a better word, the internet. The machine, kind of machine learning or learning from machines.
Well, okay. Culture Black Mirror, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So it's like you've known him longer than, and you've been alive longer than everyone else who's here, and you've known Bob longer than everyone else here. So when he says chip body. That's basically it. Yes. Yes. More or less. So sorry.
All I'm asking in like super layman's terms is, have you ever done a Google search on any of the stuff Bob's been involved with or not, and just found him randomly? Have you ever found anybody talking about Bob in relation to the sources that he has quotation marks and authority on, and been able to say, well, you know, he at least knows these people, or at least he's in this scene?
Oh, I don't know about, I mean, I don't know that when he claims that he met Captain Beefheart in 1960 something or other. I mean, I have no idea whether that actually occurred. So.
Okay. I don't know about that.
Those are ones, but I think that when he speaks about some, like we do, there was a lot of talk about the Banco Ambrosiano, thing with the Vatican Bank and Roberto Calvi and all that kind of stuff. Well, I'm very familiar with that. I mean, I'm familiar with it. A lot of it I'm familiar with because of Bob, actually, but not because I heard it from Bob, but because Bob played these things on the radio where someone else was talking about Banco Ambrosiano. So, you know, when he speaks about those things and those things related to that, I'm very familiar with it, and I know that he's not misleading anyone. I mean, it's accurate. What he's saying is what we think we know happened there, or what you know is maybe that isn't what happened, but it's the best that we know about what happened.
Okay, I love how you phrase that, but essentially, what Bob says to you in regards to that event, that matches with some of the research you have done or some of the experience you've had on your own. Is that fair?
It works completely. I mean, when he doesn't know a name or if it escapes him a bit, I mean, he's honest about it. I mean, he's very knowledgeable about a lot of the things that I know something about or that I've been interested in. He also
So Bob is a very smart guy. How do we know he's not like an expert researcher or curator? Like he's done a lot of research on these topics and he's just plugging himself in. How do you know that's not the case?
Well, there's a taint. If I may leap in, Greg, because I think I share your skepticism, Greg. There's a taint where Bob is speaking about factual historical matters, and then he switches to what he learned from a spirit medium who is channeling the people involved from after the grave, and then he tells you that he was there, and he personally was the guy pulling the trigger. Because it's a fluid package, it's very hard to disentangle, and the sane thing to do is an all or nothing thing, is just to reject it all rather than to accept it all, because oftentimes if you're not going to invest the cognitive effort to disentangle the truth from the fiction, your saner bet is to just reject it all because it's tainted.
Well, when I learned that the special program that Bob Marshall put on, CKLN, I guess it would have been around 1980, I don't know, 5 or 6 or something like that. And it was about the AIDS, the origin of AIDS. When I learned, like Bob says, I'm now allowed to play this tape. I'm allowed to play it. We spoke to this person that has real knowledge about the origin of AIDS and so on. And I remember playing that tape for other people. And then I learned later that was a medium. Now, that was shocking to me.
Wait, did you play it on CKLN?
He did.
Okay, but it was your show?
No. Oh. No. No, in 1980, somewhere around 85 or 86, Bob had this special...
86, yes. Show, of course.
He had a special show where he says, I'm now able to release this tape. I've been sitting on it, and now I'm able to play it, and it's about how the AIDS virus was created and where it was done and all that. So... you had this guy who sounded like kind of a professor, doing, you know, explaining what went on. And it seemed reasonable what was being stated. It seemed believable. And, and then later on, just in the mainstream media, basically, what this guy was saying was more or less corroborated. That and Frank Zappa said, you know, he went on Howard Stern maybe 86, and I only heard this because Bob had a recording of it and put it on somebody else's program on CKLN. I got a recording of it. It's kind of a rare recording, very rare recording. In fact. You know, I put it up on Napster or whatever those, you know, sharing sites. And it went wildfire. And I know that every one of those things, when people picked that up and sort of spread it around, it was my recording. It had to be, because I heard a little part of the CKLN intro before they played it.
Excellent.
Howard Stern.
Right on, Greg.
Howard Stern has not.
That's a valuable seed for Napster, man. Right on.
Howard Stern had not released that. He had sat on that. I don't think he's ever released that. And interestingly enough, he never played it in rerun or anything. And so somehow Bob got a copy of it, and then it was played on CKLN. Then I got a copy of it and on a videotape, and then I started spreading it around 2001. So the famous line in the Zappa thing is, you know, he said, like, they're all shocked. Howard and Robin are shocked at what Zappa's saying, that it was created in a lab and all this stuff. And then his response to Howard was, yeah, well, okay, you have to ask yourself, who's pluking the monkeys?
Pluking.
Who's pluking the monkeys?
Did he invent that right on the spot, or was pluking?
I think so, yeah.
Freeze he uses in Joe's garage.
Yeah, well, I hope he invented it.
Who's pluking the monkey? That's what he said. Because that was what the theory was going around, that these Africans were having sex with monkeys or something, right? That was what they were really. They were saying AIDS was spread from, you know, humans having sex with monkeys. So. Anyway, but then later on, I don't know when I discovered this, but, or, you know, Bob revealed that they were, that this is a medium. It wasn't some expert or some doctor or someone who was there. It was someone who was channeling somebody. And I mean, I remember being quite shocked.
I'll say this real quick, though. With all that channeling stuff, I think I remember, I don't know, Mark Stallman, he may have said a lot of that channeling, the Blavatsky stuff, all that, was a lot of intelligence work. So couldn't it be something like that, that maybe somebody just had like a, you know, that was a way to reveal certain information or maybe to trick people?
That's very...
You could have a lot of theories about that. It's possible that... anything's possible, all right? I mean, I could go through a bunch of scenarios. Wouldn't make any difference. All I'm saying is that I didn't go, God damn it, Bob's using a channeler, and that's what he's putting that up as information, and I'm supposed to believe in it. I just went, well, I mean, whatever that guy was saying, that's kind of how it started playing out when they were examining what the spread of the virus was. It was quite accurate to what later was said in the mainstream. Let's put it that way.
So we're kind of converging on a tactic of intelligence agents to discredit themselves and then say a whole bunch of true shit, but because they're clearly discreditable, make it more of an ambient idea in the air than a sourceable thing, right? So you directly implicated Bob as an intelligence asset with that.
Who did?
No, I did not.
Well, I mean,
no, because you have to play. You literally have to play with multiple threads, and that's not the total sum up of why you might perform some of those activities or have some of those activities. For instance, you could have a channeling circle that is merely, you know, off the grid, just there to, you know, for instance, gather information or to create assets or what have you. It doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of reveal over the media. Outside of that, I mean, who knows what intelligence work they're doing? If you're trying to do something for the greater good of humanity and try to release some information, if you have to bundle it up with a little bit of BS, is that so wrong? You know, I think some of that. Did that go through?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was my point. I saw my hand had been lowered. Kind of threw me off.
So, you know, it's not that I mean, when I say that, I think Clinton, I accept that you're genuinely interested in the things that I hear you talk about. The same with Brian. I mean, I'm not trying to say that you're all just trying to be frauds. I'm not saying that. I think you're genuinely interested in it, and I think you genuinely get some value out of it. And there are things that I get out of the involvement in the show where I get some, enjoyment out of, and it's not that I'm not listening to what you're saying. It's just that a lot of times I don't understand what you're talking about. Now, I mean, Bob was reading that stuff from Brian and he didn't understand what it was about.
I totally understood what it was about. It was a shorthand way of, it was like a very crowded sentence, and that's fine. It's like more of a shorthand for myself and anyone who cares enough to really look at it to just like make a few very esoteric distinctions about the sorting out the different kinds of.
Wait a minute. You're saying you understood what you wrote.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. I mean, I understand you. I mean, it'd be surprising if you said, "Yeah, I didn't get it either." I mean, I know you wrote it, and I know that you probably understand it. I'm just saying I don't understand it. Bob was confused by it. Now maybe he indicated that maybe he understood it after some questioning, but it isn't. It wasn't immediately apparent to him. That's just what I heard when I was listening to the show. And that's not necessarily a criticism of what's written.
Yeah. It wasn't a very user-friendly.
I have been psychotic. What? And also, I understand what Brian was saying because I have been psychotic. And secondly, because he was talking about all this meaning everywhere that's waiting to be burned up, and I threw out that word conflagration, which you said you had to go look up, and it just means...
Yeah, I had to look that one up.
Yeah. Like, yeah, right. But I did
look it up.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. Yeah, it's this grind, all-consuming fire that burns everything up,
yeah.
And he was...
Yeah.
All this shit laying around, and it could be very quickly... like fuel in a rocket ship consumed all too quickly, and then you're left adrift nowhere. Like there's all sorts of potent poetic meaning implied in what Brian wrote, and I was reading different meanings every time Bob was forced to repeat it, and we heard it read out loud like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times, and I heard something different in it every time because it was a dense, composition.
So okay, Clinton, you said that you talked about psychotic. Now I just looked that up. If someone asked me to describe or to define psychosis or psychotic, I wouldn't be able to do it. All right, I had to look that one up.
Okay, cool.
This is what one explanation of it is. People with psychosis, they said, this is in answer to what is an example of a psychotic behavior. People with psychosis typically experience delusions, false beliefs, for example, the people on television are sending them special messages, or that others are trying to hurt them, and hallucinations, seeing or hearing things that others do not, such as hearing voices telling them to do something or criticizing them.
Yes.
Now, I understand that is an example of psychotic behavior. Would you say that anything like that, that you've actually, what I just described as that as an example provided, would you say that that's in the range of what your psychosis or your psychotic episode was, or?
Yes, I will. And this is what my whole blog is about. But I'll be more specific. I've not heard voices telling me to do things.
Mm-hmm.
I've never hallucinated. Otherwise, very roughly speaking, our brain spends most of its time filtering stuff out and ignoring stuff so that we can pay attention to whatever we need to pay attention to. And this is the figure-ground distinction that McLuhan always makes. The bigger ground distinction is just your consciousness is whatever you're paying attention to. Oh, I'm going to look at my watch. What time is it? Oh, what's in my fridge? I need to make food. I got eggs. I got bacon. I guess I'm going to make some eggs and bacon. And meanwhile, you're ignoring everything else. And everything else in your life is, like, infinitely huge. There's so many things. You could be worrying about meteors impacting the Earth. You could be worrying about COVID. You could be forgetting your doctor's appointment. You could be, like, your imagination can run free of all the shit that's being blocked. You could be remembering the lyrics of that song you learned in French class and Alouette de Jean. So every time that you're paying attention to something, you're ignoring all the lyrics to Alouette de Jean de Alouette, right? Does that make sense? Okay. Psychosis is when the thing that's keeping you focused breaks apart and you start getting drowning in meaning from everywhere all at once. Now, McLuhan's point was that all these TV shows and all these television screens and all these newspapers flooding us with news from around the world are an external emulation of psychosis. Because you don't even know what to pay attention to. So
you're saying, is he saying it's
yeah, post-information.
Distraction?
Yes. Yes. All the news in all the world every day is a crazy distraction. But then you have heroes like Mae Brussels actually making sense of it. Or, you know, it's like, holy shit, you just made sense out of the wall of noise, which is the New York Times falling on your doorstep every week, twice on Sundays, whatever the fuck. I don't know the schedule of the New York Times. But like, you know what, my point is, personally, in your head, you gotta just pay attention to one thing at a time if you're gonna be a fucking real human. And the psychosis is the personal experience of the thing that's blocking everything you're ignoring falling apart. And you stop being able to ignore the shit that you don't need to pay attention to. And now you're paying attention to everything, and you hear the waiter say one thing across the restaurant, and you go, oh my god, the waiter's talking about me. It's like, no, he's not. You shouldn't have even listened to that. It was boring. You should be listening to what your fucking date is saying. You shouldn't be listening to what the waiter is whispering over fucking there. You shouldn't be reading the ads on the bus. You shouldn't be fucking, you know, like, analyzing every lyric in the song on the radio to figure out if it's about you or not. Like psychosis is when the barriers to you ignoring shit get broken. And
okay, let me say this real quick, though, Clinton. Suppose you were worth a good amount of money. Suppose you had some kind of, you know, faculties or some sort of authority where you are a valuable person, whether you're a politician, businessman, or whatever.
You got a reputation, which is outside of you.
Yeah, you got public credulity, as Brian would say.
Yes, right.
Yeah. So let's just say you're one of those type of people. Now, if somebody wanted to invest a lot of money into making somebody like that feel crazy, then I guess hoiking up that idea that none of that could be possible might be dangerous to that outlier individual. And that's something I would just kind of throw out there.
Right. People who are actually surrounded by public scrutiny do not have the convenience of just saying, oh, I'm nobody. No, they weren't really talking about. Because, like, celebrities actually, they walk into a room and everyone knows who they are. You're right.
Yeah.
These are celebrity
major mental health hazard, no doubt.
Yes. Becoming a celebrity is a major mental health hazard. And your psychosis can be legitimized because people actually are talking about you and pretending to ignore you. Yes, exactly. That's very true. I feel very guilty. I feel very lucky to be an absolute nobody who works at the beer store. That's another answer. Okay, that's the answer you were fishing for an hour ago, Greg.
I like how the first thing you said was that you were very guilty to just be working at the beer store, because that's the,
isn't that great?
That's the other thrust of that questioning, like, why is this all you're doing with your life or something like that? Shouldn't you be more important if you're that brilliant?
Because I'm a coward and I want to remain a nobody forever so that I can...
No, it's also the longer you remain a nobody, the better, because you need to, you know... If you, like, it takes a long time to gestate the ideas that are the real shit that will save the world, you know? If you spend all your time making sure that you're putting stuff out there and starting to build a brand, like, before you go through years and years of learning and experience,
mm-hmm.
then you're
right. Okay. You're right, but I don't know what the timeline is, and I don't know what the deadlines are, and I don't know where I'm at, because it's all very me making it up as I go along with the few feedbacks I have.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Greg, though, because we're explaining shit to Greg.
Cha-cha-chang-chang.
So, Greg, a psychosis is when normal people who can just pay attention to what they need to pay attention to suddenly start being surrounded by strange, weird information, and their carpet is telling them something, and the ads on the bus are telling them something, and the songs on the radio are all about them, because their brain is making meaning out of everything. They've lost the ability to focus. And now the ground is becoming the figure, and everything's figure, and they don't know what to pay attention to anymore.
Mm.
And they get suspicious, and they get paranoid.
And you're saying that, now, are you talking about this being a past problem for you that you overcome, or are you saying that you're susceptible to it now?
The worst of it. I've gotten through the worst of it, and I act like I'm a celebrity in the way that sorry, what's your name, bro? I don't know you.
Is Clint talking? Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's fair. My name's Ned.
Hi, Ned. Okay. So Ned
said, hey,
if you got a lot of money and then, like, everything you're saying, Clinton, doesn't apply because people may actually be after you. And he's totally right. Right? So if you're a nobody and you think that people are watching you, you're probably just crazy. But if you are rich and you suspect people are paying attention to you, you actually have a justifiable claim. Right? So,
and there's also, and let me add this in just tiny bit real quick, there's also the Walter Bogart area, for instance, where kids may grow up and become assets without actually having the wealth, but may just become important because of some earlier childhood trauma or the way they were raised as far as, you know, performing a certain mission.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that in there because Bob knows the word.
Scary to think about. I cracked open my Bible a few months ago and I read the first couple chapters or whatever of Matthew. And when it got to the part where it said, prepare ye the way of the Lord, I immediately thought, like, oh, Jesus was set up. He didn't have a chance. People had, like, plans for him. And Jesus was just ignorantly born, and then the whole world was already prepared to go treat him away to make him turn out the way that he did. That was just my own private interpretation of the verses as I was reading them, right? So it's like, when you talk about children being born, and then there being plans that they cannot possibly be conscious of, which are just environmental to them, like developmental noise to them, which shape them. Then, like, that's the height of vulnerability. That's very sad, disgusts me, except in the nurturing context of developmental psychology and how to turn children into mature, rational, free adults, you know, in a liberal sense, right? Anyway, but that's children. Adults need to grow the fuck up. Because they should have been grown up already, except for our society failed them to get them any further beyond consumer whores. I'm sorry, Greg.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of overlap here with the communist stuff, because that's what the whole false consciousness, like, oh, your class consciousness, you think you need to be a worker, but you need to wake up from that. This is all, like, developmental psychology. Wake up from your illusion that capitalism is good so that you can join the revolution, brother. You know? Like, this is all people trying to awaken you for psychosis to go see the patterns you have been ignoring your whole life.
Well, that falls into my idea that, well, you're talking about a group of people trying to convince another group of people that they've been controlled and that they need to reform.
Right. And what this means is something like inducement of a small psychosis which breaks them out of their equilibrium or their comfort zone and makes them start questioning things they had never questioned before. That's what the psychosis is. A psychosis is a massive re-questioning of everything. But personal growth depends on, like, something I'm going to call a mini-psychosis of getting thrown uncomfortably into questioning your former place so that maybe you can grow into a larger, more aware place.
Well, I think if I'm to look back at my experience, not only on this program, but maybe especially on the one that would occur on Saturday nights and so on, I think it's not a role that I want to take, but I think it's a role that I'm assumed to have taken up as my mantle. And that is that my purpose here is to deprogram people from a cult.
Mm-hmm. Or the cult of capitalism.
No, I'm viewed as an enemy because not by everyone, but by a lot of people, that I'm here that I have to agree with everything that's said, or else, you know, why are you here? What are you doing here? You know, are you trying to break our spirit or something? You know, there's that. I find that is the common drift as it relates to me by some of the participants.
You're not very nuanced at the stuff people can have intellectual rigor for to separate the wheat from the chaff. Like, you're not winnowing. You don't know enough McLuhan to go tell everyone, yeah, McLuhan is right about that, but Bob is perverting it with that part.
Well, I don't think I'm talking so much about that, actually. I think I'm talking about when I go into some kind of criticism or when I say something, it doesn't have to even be too pointed. People say, well, you're just here to, you're here, you know, you don't believe in ION.
I don't believe in ION either.
Yeah, I know, but I think I'm seen as the one who, even though you should also have that reputation, I think I have that reputation more than anybody, and yet I don't really think that I've gone on about it anywhere. Well, you used to go on it a bit more, I think, than I ever did. But I have that reputation. It's like if I intervene in something, I'm not even talking about you or Brian, but a lot of the people who come on here, it's sort of they're going, well, you know, you're not with us, so why are you here?
I'm more nimble and I play a long game. I've got a long game, and so I suffer many short-term humiliations towards my long game. It's
Clinton, what's your long game? I'm curious.
Oh, to improve. Oh, well, actually, I modeled it off of the dude who wrote all of the stuff that I learned my intro to tarot cards from. And his name is Paul Foster Case.
Is that like divination tarot cards?
Yes, okay. It is. When I knew that I was going to go crazy again, I decided to learn a little bit about the tarot, and I found some old mail order, mail correspondence tarot courses from the 1930s by a guy named Paul Foster Case. And when you read about Paul Foster Case, you realize that what he was doing is he left the Golden Dawn, the Order of the Golden Dawn, disgusted by Aleister Crowley. And he decided to create his own Kabbalistic tarot discipline, which was very carefully decrowlified. Like, he purified what was good from the Golden Dawn Kabbalistic tarot teachings from the Aleister Crowley shit that he hated. And then he created this new order called the Builders of the Adamantium. No, sorry, the Builders of the Adamantium. Adamantium is whatever the fuck Wolverine's got. But, you know, Paul Luther Case creates Builders of the Adamantium. And that is his decrowlified lesson in the Golden Dawn esoteric Kabbalah using tarot cards. So anyway.
Okay, so real quick though, as somebody who's obviously, I was not familiar with tarot cards. I looked them up real quick, so I've seen them before. In regards to Aleister Crowley, I've heard a little bit of him. I've heard of a lot of horrible things said against him. Obviously, Robert Anton Wilson talks a lot about this, about how some of the things that were said against him were just outright lies or things he invented. I'm familiar a little bit with the Golden Dawn, of how they would heavily trick people and then break that somnambulism later, supposedly. So just based off that little bit of knowledge, what you said to me is still a bit ambiguous. Because I'm just not so familiar with the topic. So what's the main purpose of all that?
Okay, so the idea of taking a poisoned discipline and then reconstituting its good parts while purging the poison and then creating a new curriculum has appealed to me. And that's what needs to be done in American education when it comes to critical theory and literary criticism. All the humanities, all the universities in education need to not be purged of their postmodern neo-Marxist bullshit, but rather be re-equilibrated into a better understanding of the human condition, which isn't just mind-washing bullshit, right?
Who's gonna agree, though? How? What kind of counselor, what type of authority figure, or what type of mechanism would actually come to any sort of about what the proper form of education should be.
There isn't some single top-down judge who can be imposed from on high who's going to go,
okay,
fire tenured professors. There is no easy answer here. But going forward, what you do is you demonstrate something better, and then it gains market appeal, right? But, like, I am applying this rubric to everything. So it's like, I love what Bob has done with McLuhan, but also it's pathologically poisoned by Bob's megalomaniacal shenanigans. I want to learn from Bob while also separating the wheat from the chaff, the same way that Paul Foster Case learned everything he could from the Golden Dawn while extracting the Aleister Crowley bullshit from the good stuff that he liked. The same way that, disciplines get good and they get popular and then they get subverted by outside forces who try to misdirect them to their own good. And what else can you do but try and purify the good from the bad in the strain and try to create, this is software. Open source software, I'm sorry to say it. Free software is my true love, but open source software, the bastard thunder derivation, nevertheless allows for forks, a software fork. Oh, look, OpenOffice got bought by Oracle. Oh, my God, or let's fucking bullshit. We have to fork it. We're going to go make LibreOffice. Bullshit, and we're going to go launch our fork, right? How much software... How much open source software do you use, which is a fork from some good software that went bad, but because it was open source, someone could fork it, right? Like, that's the game here, and it's the game at every level.
And I guess
when the good shit comes bad, fork it.
Let me say two things real quick. So before you answer, I mean, one of the things I obviously want to know is how do you separate the good from the bad? The wheat from the chaff. And then the second part would be in regards to open source software and the society that type of software, that type of technology is born into. If you just have a bunch of open source guys who are doing work for free and all that, how are they going to go up against big corporations who are already very powerful in that society? So we're talking big car manufacturers, big clothing manufacturers, the media that's already there. Those guys have advertising bucks. Those guys have methodologies, ways to hypnotize and somnambulize the populace. So when the open source guys come up there, they may have the greatest meaning in the world, and all they want is the best for humanity. but they don't have the actual marketing dollars. They don't have those type of people in there. Therefore, the technology does not grow. And eventually it gets monopolized by somebody who can advertise it.
Grow, exactly. You're trapped in a capitalist... Hat tip to Greg here. You're trapped in a capitalist paradigm where you think market share fucking matters. I don't want to grow open source. Fuck it. If only a tiny sliver of people use it forevermore, great. Those people will run the world. Everyone else can use the slop.
Well, then what if those people become so elite? Like, what if there's a group of maybe 10,000 people who, over the span of 20 years, they have AI-powered drones that could kill just the whole entire population? Wouldn't they be able to impose whatever type of government or whatever type of currency they want to on the population?
Okay, you're right. I need to adjust what I just said there.
No, you're fine. I think we're having fun. I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here, but also like things that I think about.
And so I already forgot the answer to it, but the second question.
We from the chat.
Oh, it reminded me of Remember the Mask with Jim Carrey, the movie?
No.
Jim Carrey puts on this ancient like mask and becomes a crazy bombastic character. There's a scene where everyone's about to die because there's dynamite in the building and it's going to explode and kill everyone. It's a bomb. And Jim Carrey, while wearing this ancient voodoo mask, which makes him into a crazy bombastic character, takes the dynamite, swallows it whole, his neck inflates in an animated exaggeration as he swallows this dynamite. It explodes in his stomach, and then he goes, "Oh, that's a spicy meatball!" And then he saves everyone from the explosion. So, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? You don't. You literally die from the poison. It doesn't actually kill you. You get reborn.
Yeah. Yeah. Good answer. Very good answer.
Yeah, thank you. To the second point about McLuhan in his book Typhon in America, he says we need intellectuals. Not everyone can be intellectual, but we need to keep alive enough intellectuals who are smart to like be guiding the perception of shit. We can't have no intellectuals. And what's happening right now in society is we have no intellectuals at all, and that's horrible. Like, there needs to be a minority of smart people who lead shit. And I see that minority of smart people as people who use free software, which includes open source software, I guess, if you want to get technical. I hate open source software from my own ideological perspective, but, like, I get the reason. And insofar as if we're going to control our computers, there needs to be a minority of people who control our computers who can at least rely a resource to ground that keeps everything grounded. That's all. And I know that the black box of large language models and every other neural network thwarts that because there is no source code. It's just the actual models themselves are impenetrable. We do still need to keep alive the community that we can do that source code has become so broken into higher level scripting languages like Python, PreScript, because people who learn to code and they only learn in high level languages but aren't in touch with what the compiler is doing or what their operating system is doing are not actually in touch with the computer anymore. And I'm one guy, and I humbly focus on that problem as my technical challenge. I don't know what to say about AI right now, where I'm at right now, but where I'm at with source code and free software and open source stuff, we don't need to increase our market share. We're not competing. We don't need more people to use LibreOffice than Microsoft Office. We need enough people to be using free software to keep human sanity alive somewhere on the planet. like Foundation, like Harry Seldon in Isaac Asimov's Foundation.
I use LibreOffice.
Hello?
God bless you, Greg. God bless you.
Hello.
Am I not supposed to use LibreOffice?
You are supposed to use LibreOffice. God bless you.
Oh, okay. Hello. Good. Good.